Welcome to Bushwick Junction on Radio Free Brooklyn. This is your host, Asha. This is our third episode of Bushwick Junction, and we have a very special guest with us today. Bushwick Junction is a show about life's inflection points. It's a show about the crossroads in our lives, the decisions that we choose to take when we get to them. It's about how we decide to do things, whether we tap into our intuition or make lists until we can't even think straight anymore. And it's about whether our choices matter. It's a show about whether when we get to... I'm really struggling today.
Yeah.
I usually have this written down in front of me. Whether our choices matter, how much the things that we decide to do or not do really affect our fate. So I'll let today's guest introduce himself. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Vijay. I'm a host of the Truth to Power show on Radio Free Brooklyn, and I consider myself a poet and librarian. I'm a librarian by trade, but I consider myself a poet and a Buddhist. Over the years, I've been studying Buddhism. The past 10 years, I've been studying Buddhism, and a lot of my poetry is informed by that, and it's informed by my life story. So,
that's a great introduction. Yeah. I like the non-brief introduction, getting into the details. So I think that to start out today's episode, we're going to go through Vijay's junctions just like we do with everyone else. But he wanted to share with us a poem or two.
Yeah. So this poem is from the collection Escape from Samsara, which I published in 2016. And a lot of the poems are directly informed by my life and the junctions in my life. So this one's called Confession Poem. When he saw me reading a Buddhist book, my sleep study technician let me know I will go to hell. He studied all the religions, and the only way to protect yourself is by accepting Christ's love. Despite my non-belief in the Godhead of Jesus, I cried at the ending of The Last Temptation of Christ and felt the release of all the suffering I'd endured as a child. At the age of 11, a bully had turned his seat to me to say, "You're a waste of life that no one cares about." After days of this, I asked the teacher to change seats, and she condescendingly said, "It's about time you asked me that." I had my first crush in the sixth grade on a beautiful brunette. When asked by a classmate how I felt about Mary, I said, "She's okay, I guess," and ran my hands through my hair. Years later, when Mary had posted pro-life images of an aborted baby on a Facebook discussion about women's rights, instead of responding, I would recall the image of her crossing her arms behind her back that first day I met her and the rising inflections of the St. Joseph's nuns singing her namesake's praise.
Wow.
So, yeah, thank you. So that kind of gives you a sense of my childhood, because like I grew up in Staten Island, New York. I was born and raised in Staten Island, New York.
Okay.
And I went to Catholic school from first to eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were followers of Satya Sai Baba, who is a guru who lived in India, and he died only in 2011. So they very much were into the unity of all religions. The movement, Satya Sai Baba movement, was about uniting all religions. So they sent me to Catholic school, and it was a difficult time, but it was informed by this idea that that I was like a student of all religions, you know.
That's super interesting.
Thank you.
Is that what's your relationship to their religion, essentially? Do you?
So I appreciate Jesus as a figure,
mm-hmm.
and we had a big discussion with a friend of mine for 25 years. He was raised as a Catholic, and on my show I had a discussion with him about him moving towards atheism, and I was beside him a lot of those years, and I think that definitely my thoughts towards religion are very complex,
mm-hmm.
but now I kind of align myself with Buddhism because I feel like I'm more of an observer of life, and another guest was saying about how experience, imagination, observation are the three things that are the foundation for writing. So my experiences, I observe my experiences, and I add in an element of imagination that helps inform me as a writer and as a person. Kind of exploring my emotional landscapes, my psychological landscapes, to understand my own experience and be an observer. I think Buddhism is very much aligned with kind of observer mentality,
yeah.
observing ones through meditation or through meditative spaces.
Can you repeat the three things?
So experience,
uh-huh.
observation, and then imagination.
Cool.
So,
I love that.
Thank you.
I love elegant principles. So the first question on this show, you kind of already addressed, I'd say. I think mm-hmm. you definitely got at it with your parents and their religion, but tell us about the situation you were born into and what a normal life outcome might have looked like for the person you were born as.
Sure. I was born August 8th, 1978 in Staten Island, New York.
Oh, so I did a little bit. You're interested in astrology.
Yeah, I
did. I didn't tell you, but I'm very into astrology also.
I took some classes with a religious teacher of mine, who I continue to keep up with. And I looked at my birth chart, and mm-hmm. I kind of understand, have somewhat of an understanding of kind of that, although I'm sun sign is Leo, mm-hmm. Pisces is a big influence on me because it was on the horizon, ascendant. Uh-huh. Is descendant, and Pisces, the Piscean ideas, and Neptune is a major influence on me. Mm-hmm. So Neptune being kind of into the intuition, the spirituality, and that's been a big influence on me. So all these, I don't really think of them as planetary influences per se, but energies in our lives.
Totally.
And these centers of energies have had huge influences on me. Yeah,
I see it the same way. Like, maybe it is the planet, of course, this big celestial object and its position in the sky is exerting some energy mm-hmm. and influencing us in some way. Can you just like real quick go through your whole birth chart? So just so I can like...
I don't know if I could do that, but I can, basically there's like... Because I looked at it and I studied it, uh-huh. but I didn't retain a lot of that information.
Right.
But I know like the moon sign, I believe, is Libra. But I can't really... Those three things are the major... That's all I can really say about that. But my interest in it is basically in how the energies move throughout my life.
Yeah.
And last time I did a reading, he was saying that things were starting to align in 2018. So basically, like, you know, on my 40th birthday, he was saying, like, you know, what he communicated to me was that all the planets are kind of really building towards that momentum, that he gave a lot of positive aspects of the planetary. The progress chart, they call it. So
right.
It's like how we're influenced by as we move along in life. Yeah.
Cool. We did get a little off track there with that question, though. Can you tell me? So I know you're a Leo. I know you're born in August, born in Staten Island. Uh-huh. And I know that you went to Catholic school and I know your parents' religion. Does that cover it all?
That covers the beginning of my life. Yeah. And then I think the next major junction, address like kind of writing and my interest in writing. And the next major juncture was when I went to college.
Really?
So
no childhood junction.
Yeah. I think that the one junction was like kind of like, because I went to in the poem, it kind of addresses like my feelings towards the childhood. And, mm-hmm. You know, in the fourth grade, I remember I started this book called Professor Wazit in the Land of Waz, which is basically like a riff off of the Oz series I was reading.
Uh-huh.
So I was very interested in Wizard of Oz, and I read a lot of the books. I think there's a series. Like Frank Baum wrote the first, I think, 10 or so books, and then Ruth Thompson, I believe, or I forget the first name, but Thompson wrote a series of books after that. So I read like pretty much all of them by the time I hit fourth or fifth grade. And then I started writing this book called Professor Wazit, which is about this professor who created a world in a microcosm.
Mm-hmm.
And he observed that the prince of this world was like kidnapped. So he decided, him and his talking dog decided to go into the world to intervene and like try to save the prince. So I had this whole storyline kind of mapped out and I was writing it. And then some kid, I guess, like stole the manuscript and started scribbling over it.
Oh no!
So I'm not really sure who did it. It was just basically I found it one day, kind of out of my bag, and it was all scribbled all over. So, but then I haven't really done a novel attempt since then. I'm now a major novel kind of thing, but I've done a lot of like writing, you know, since then, mostly in poetry and memoir and stuff like that.
This book that you just read from, for those listening from home, is it a published book? Did you self-publish it?
Yeah, I self-published it, but it's available through Amazon and such.
Cool.
So it's called Escape from Samsara, and then Samsara. So Samsara being like the endless cycle of rebirth and birth that we go through.
Yeah.
But I define it as the psychological process by which we create the world we exist in moment by moment. So that's kind of the way I frame the Samsara. And then escaping the psychological process by which we break free of these habitual patterns and find inner peace.
So, wow.
Yeah.
So your first junction is basically starting to write.
Yeah.
And it's something that's still part of your life right now. I feel that people who, you know, are writers at their core or creators at their core describe like, I have to. I can't live without it. I always have. Did you feel that way? Did you like when you tried out writing, do you remember it being just like very natural to you, or did it feel like you trying something new and liking it?
Yeah, I think that since in the early childhood, I was a very big reader.
Yeah.
So that was that finding my voice and the inspiration of all these books that I was reading gave me the impetus to continue to write.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a struggle in the sense of craft wise. So, although the desire to write is very fluent in me,
mm-hmm.
Sitting down and creating something that was, you know, since I was reading a lot of classics growing up in the middle school and high school. So to come up to that level, I felt like my standards are very high. So, I was reading material that was, you know, extremely some of the greatest literature written. And then to kind of have that standard was a little difficult for me.
Yeah.
But then I started, when I broke into poetry in high school, when I started to understand poetry, it started to become more natural to me that this is the form in which I want to express myself in. And that felt a little bit more fluid for me.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I also wrote a book in the fourth grade, and I've never written anything since.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote, you know, in college and when I had to, but as far as self-directed writing, apart from journaling, my book was called Peach and the Unicorn, and it was also about an imaginary world.
Oh, cool.
And
like fantasy?
Yeah. I mean, I was in the fourth grade. I was like 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never written anything since then, really. It's just not my avenue.
Yeah.
So your next big junction is going to college. Mm. I like that one as a junction. I think deciding where and how and under what circumstances to go to college is kind of like the first time we really individuate in our society.
Yeah, I remember this moment when I was reading about Vassar College. They had this description in the college book that said something along the lines of, that the kids of the college were considered themselves beautiful people, and they drank black coffee and smoked clove cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I think that now looking back on it, perhaps the writer of that passage was trying to be kind of tongue-in-cheek or sarcastic.
Yeah, kind of mean.
It seemed almost like, you know, now looking back, I realized when I read it, I was like, beautiful people smoking clove cigarettes, what, you know, drinking black coffee. That sounds so great.
Yeah.
You know, but I, you know. But the reality
his
was that
dig like your dream.
Yeah, exactly.
So you grew up as a city kid, though, or were you mostly limited to Long Island?
Staten Island. So it's part of part of New York City, but it has a suburban feel,
right?
To it.
Did you spend a lot of time in Manhattan?
No, not really. I mean, we went to Manhattan occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
So with Staten Island kids and New York City kids was called Manhattan the city. So even though it's a borough, you know, all the boroughs are part of New York City. So we would be like, we'll go to the city every now and then. We'll take the ferry in. But, the main time I spent was on Staten Island and such, yeah.
Gotcha. So you sort of had exposure to and had a taste for kids who wore all black and smoked clove cigarettes.
Yeah.
Where did your parents have, were they supportive of Vassar?
Yeah, I think that my sister had gone to Bryn Mawr.
Oh.
So they had some, you know, these kind of very similar the Seven Sisters and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were supportive. I think that a lot of ways my sister kind of paved the road for me to be more free with my choices because, you know, ultimately she ended up becoming a doctor and she followed a more traditional route for many Indian Americans. But for me, they gave me the liberty to choose. I'm kind of fast forwarding, but it gave me the liberty to be myself and, you know, kind of not feel the pressure that sometimes Indian Americans feel
about
you know, being science or being in. I was able to go pursue the humanities and all that. My parents are very encouraging about that.
That's great. Sounds like they're very open-minded people.
Yeah, thank you.
So you chose Vassar. How was your experience there?
So, I mean, it was difficult because what happened was in the first 6 months or so, you know, I had this infatuation with someone, a woman who was attending the school, and the infatuation was not reciprocated, was not mutual.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, when the relationship or friendship dissolved, I fell into a little bit of depression. Also because of the fact that it was difficult for me to transition into college. I mean, I'd been kind of in a sheltered environment to some extent. And for me, it was difficult to transition to college, kind of going off on my own.
Yeah, that was the worst year of my life.
Yeah, it was very difficult. But then I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 97 of that, like right in the middle of the first year.
Okay.
Or 97, yeah, around that time. So I ended up leaving Vassar to go to commute to, from home to school at Rutgers University. So that was kind of the better. I ended up, you know, kind of giving myself a little bit more space to, you know.
Did you take some time off?
A little bit, but I ultimately ended up finishing the degree only a year late.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a question of like cutting off a semester and then semester there, here and there. And but I finished a year. I finished a year of studies at Vassar.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's a big decision.
Yeah. It was tough.
Was it your decision? Were your parents weighing in?
I mean, like what happened was basically it was a really tough decision, mm-hmm. because I didn't want to leave what I considered a kind of prestigious school. And I felt like, for me, I felt like going to Rutgers might be a little bit of a kind of a status, mm-hmm. you know, the status of having a degree from Vassar might have been. But I mean, now I can't look back because it's more for my own health is more important. So, I end up going to Rutgers. But, you know, it also in regards to the kind of illness and in regards to the experience I had at that time, there was a lot of kind of disorganized thinking, you know. So, but I was able to overcome that by just focusing on that. I had to, you know, kind of study and get the degree and all this kind of thing. And I was hospitalized for like a week. So I was hospitalized for like a week during that time period. So that kind of disrupted things. But thankfully, I was able to. I only lost about a year in the process, and as far as like time goes, like, you know, as studies go. And such,
right.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Did you find that Rutgers was a healthier environment for you?
I think because I was commuting.
Right.
So I didn't have too much of a. I wasn't entangled in these kinds of things that dorm life sometimes gets you involved in. You know, like in other words, like. I wasn't so dependent on people to be there.
Right.
You know, I was kind of allowed a liberty of kind of going home and having my base at home and coming to class and then just making friends as I was able to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I had one other. You brought up the point of disorganized thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's such an interesting part of making decisions. Like, I'd not really thought about it that way, but it seems like the more organized your thoughts are, the easier it must be for you to like look at all the data involved in a decision.
Exactly.
And make it.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, maybe a little bit too much organization could cause problems too, because there are infinite data points to every decision. And if you're super organized, then you kind of have too much to process all at once. I don't know if the brain can handle it.
Yeah. I think also in the question of being 17 and 18, you know, there's a lot of emotional and emotional stuff that comes up. Whereas, you know, when I snapshot myself now versus at 18, this is 20 years ago now, I'm like 39 now. So when I think about 20 years progress, I think the 18-year-old me was very much like, there was really a learning curve about how to deal with emotions and sexuality. So that was something that now I'm very much, I'm more rational, I guess. I don't know. I'm more like very like structured in my thinking. I have like a baseline of thoughts, and I use like really an analytic approach. I have very cerebral analytic approach now, as opposed to what I was in 19. I was kind of very impulsive and very emotionally driven, and the decisions were almost like impulsively driven.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that must be something that happens when you get older. I'm like, I'm getting there. I can see it. And I think the real skill there is, you know, you can have the cerebral approach. You can have the like the way you want to approach things. But then when your feelings get really big, it's so easy to abandon that and just go based on how you're feeling.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. So what's the next big junction? What happened after college?
So after college, I started to pursue a career in teaching. So
what did you want to be when you were older as a younger person?
Well, in college, I wanted to pursue theater and drama because I was very interested in high school. And I wanted to be like a director of a film or direct filmmaker or a director of theater. So, because I felt like I really, high school and college, I was very interested in kind of these these filmmakers like Kubrick and Spielberg, or people who had like a body of work that like was their really defined them as a visionary, and these visionary directors, and what's the name, the guy, Martin Scorsese, people like them, where they had a whole body of work that was like defining them as a person. I really was interested in that. And I kind of had to abandon that because I felt like Indian Americans were not making headway in, and not so much by Indian Americans. I feel like there was a lot of kind of clicky kind of people in the theater world where people just simply weren't interested in, they were clicky and they were kind of like, you know, very, these kind of social things, especially given that I was having trouble with the, you know, kind of my disorganized thinking and this kind of in that time period. I found it very difficult to break into these social circles that were theater people and drama people.
Interesting.
Yeah. So ultimately I decided I would go. My mom was a teacher. Mm-hmm. So my sister, as I mentioned, had followed my father's footsteps, who was a doctor. She went into medical career. So I ended up saying, oh, you know, I guess I'll follow my mom's footsteps and going to education.
Okay. But
I remember there was one instance where on the first day where, even though I didn't enjoy substitute teaching, mm-hmm. but I ended up going to New York Teaching Fellows. And there was one moment where I was sitting in the orientation and the student comes up to the mic and says, you know, he says he's kind of praising teachers and he's saying, you guys aren't in it for the money. And, you know, that's not why you're here. And I'm thinking to myself, why the hell am I here? Like, I'm in it, not that I was in it for the money, but I don't want to be impoverished either. And the way, you know, like I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing? And like the first year or so, actually, I didn't even survive the first year of teaching. 6 months or so, the first few months, it was just such a torture, such an agony. Because I just come out of college, basically. I was like a few years after college. And I'm only like 10 years older than these kids. Mm-hmm. And they didn't show me any respect.
Right.
You know, and it was so difficult. And I barely knew what I was doing. I'd gotten very little training. The teaching fellows kind of jump starts you into teaching with doing classes simultaneously to earn the degree simultaneously. So It was tough, and I tried to weather it, but then I was like, I can't handle this. So I left teaching. The decision to leave teaching was, and also at the time, the economy was extremely, like, in the slumps. So, but the decision to leave teaching was a pivotal decision, I think, that I couldn't, it was very much an acknowledgement that I'd reached a breaking point, that I had to find a career that was more suited to me. So some of the goals that I had with going into teaching, about education, about literacy, was fulfilled in my career as a librarian. So I ended up doing the master's in library science and becoming a librarian. And
Hang on, we're going too fast. I love the way you're describing this decision to first be and then no longer be a teacher. How long was that phase of your life total?
So I was a substitute teacher after college. For a couple of years, and then a year or so I spent a summer training with teaching fellows, and then a year passed until between 2001 and 2005 or so, I was spent in the teaching kind of arena.
Okay.
In some way.
So 4 years?
Yeah, about 4 years. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think about the you described to me the decision to become a teacher following your mom's footsteps and whatever, the other things that went into it.
Yeah.
It's crazy that in describing that experience to me, it sounds like there was no junction, no pivotal moment or decision made where you were like, I shouldn't be doing this anymore. It was like screaming itself at you.
Yeah.
Like before you even started, you were like, I don't know if this is the right thing. Is that right?
Yeah, I felt really compelled to do it simply because I didn't know what else to do. So I felt kind of like in a tight, like the currents were taking me there. I felt very much compelled, mainly because as I was saying about the economy at that time, I couldn't find jobs. You know, I was trying to look at different things. I didn't even know really what kind of jobs to look for.
Yeah.
But substitute teaching was an easy job to get, a per diem job to get. And as long as you showed up, you know, you basically were getting regular work. And I did work at a theater, George Street Playhouse in New Jersey, kind of keeping my passion for theater going. But I felt that kind of feeling that theater groups and theater cliques were very much kind of not really attuned to. There weren't
just
too many opportunities.
Social environment.
Yeah.
It's definitely a bunch of really emotional, really performative people. And I can totally see how clicky it must have been.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you brought up race. We're kind of backtracking here. I did want to talk more about the theater thing. That you brought up race in relation to that environment. I'm also Indian American, and it's kind of an alienating space in the art world in general.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not as common. There aren't like your people in that world.
And now suddenly we're starting to see a rise in in Indian Americans being prominent in the arts. And it really touches my heart because I almost feel like I want to dive back in, because I feel like maybe there'll be more opportunities now if I were to go back. But I don't know how I would negotiate that at this stage. But
interesting.
Something, I think definitely with my writing, it's encouraged me when I hear, I listen to people like Nazeez Ansari and all these other comedians. And because I did some improv, I'm kind of skipping ahead, but I returned to theater in some way in my later life. And so I was able to keep it as something I'm in touch with.
Let's go back to your master's. So when you decided to do that, was it your escape car from teaching? Were you like, all right, I need to be done teaching. What am I going to do next? And it was that?
Exactly. Yeah. So when I got out of teaching, there was a period of time where I was like, I was trying to do an assessment, like a vision board or not little. Maybe I did do a vision board. I don't remember. But I did some kind of assessment of where I was at, what I wanted to do. And my sister was like, librarianship might suit you, because I had very much an interest in literature. I had very much an interest in education. And I had very much an interest in kind of these kinds. I wanted to go into special libraries. So I wanted to my objective was to work in a very specialized library. I had this dream of working for Academy of Arts and Sciences for their library of films and such.
Oh, cool.
So, and then I could get invited to the Academy Awards, and that would kind of bring together my passion for film and a career in library science or something.
I really relate to what you just described of inventing your dream niche, being I should specialize in this, but then do this very specific thing, and you don't even know if that thing really exists. But I relate to that a lot. Your sister recommended it to you, though.
Yeah, she was
it's not one of those careers that people think of.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think that it was on the peripherally, it was on my, just because from being in libraries and such, but I didn't think of it as a career, as you're saying. So she was like, she kind of came to me and she was like, no, I really think this career, and especially, I think she had looked at some job outlook at that time.
Hmm.
And at that time in 2005, 2006, the job outlook was positive for it. But then actually, I got hired because of my teaching experience, actually, ironically, that when I was when I was doing the master's in library science, my professor recommended me for a children's librarian position connected me to the library position with Queen's Library because of the fact that I had some teaching experience. So one thing kind of, something kind of leads into the other. And then I end up getting hired by Queen's Library. As a public librarian, as a general chosen librarian in the public library sphere. And although it wasn't, kind of what I envisioned as, as I was saying, the special libraries and all this kind of thing, I kind of felt like it was a smooth transition into what I was doing before, what I had some experience with, and going into that, that kind of thing, yeah.
Cool. So you've been doing that ever since, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And have you worked for basically the exact same job this whole time?
No, I've worked for Queen's Library, but I have a little bit of a restlessness when it comes to career, I think. I think I've exhibited some restlessness in the sense that, every few years I apply for a different position, usually advancement.
Hmm.
So I try to go for an advanced position. I try to increase the, try to develop my skill sets and try to increase the challenges, trying to one-up myself. So at Queen's Library, I became, first I was started as a children's librarian. I joined to general librarianship, and then I transferred into, I got promoted into assistant manager. So, the next level up, assistant manager, and then supervising librarian, which is basically another level of assistant manager. And then, I think that this is kind of, I've been moving branches as well. So the different branches. It's amazing to me that, within Queens itself, a borough of New York City has such a rich, each neighborhood has a distinct flavor, a very, it's so unique.
Yeah.
And something that New Yorkers.
Do you live in Queens?
Now I live in Queens, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you work and live in what neighborhood?
So I live in Kew Gardens. Actually, it's strange because like within a few blocks, there's like different neighborhoods. So I would say Briarwood, Kew Gardens, right near Forest Hills. So I end up working at Forest Hills. So
gotcha.
Now I'm working at Forest Hills. Yeah.
Forest Hills is crazy.
Yeah.
Like I went out to the venue, the music venue out there, mm-hmm. and it just looks like another planet.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe that it's, you know, 20 minutes away from Brooklyn.
Exactly, exactly. Crazy. Yeah, Forest Hills is a really great, great neighborhood. And I think the Rockaways are very much underappreciated. I worked at the Rockaways for 3 years.
Oh, really? And, at the library there?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
You're eating right. Ish.
What's that?
Oh, dear.
You're going to bed early.
Oh, is that okay?
Huh.
Yeah.
All right.
Interrupted by a... Oh, that's okay. So,
where is the studio at? Anyway,
yeah.
Sorry about that, folks. Technical difficulties. So you've moved branches, like physically, where you go to work.
Yeah, I was working in the Rockaways 3 years, and then I worked in Steinway or Astoria area. So I think like Astoria, Steinway, you know, the area, Long Island City area, Forest Hills, and Rockaways are my three favorite places in Queens. I think, yeah.
Let's lean into the moment of restlessness that you're describing. That seems like it's almost like a mini junction.
Exactly.
I want you to go into detail about like what that starts to feel like very detailed, like, and how you know that you're having one of those and like how you decide to deal with it and what ends up coming of it.
So basically what happens is, you know, when I start to fall into, I don't like patterns. Routine is a one way of looking at it, but I don't like system, like kind of falling into a sleep mode where we make decisions based on the series of decisions we made prior. So when we go into like, you know, every day becomes like a repetition of the day before and this kind of pattern I try to avoid. I try to always introduce in my decision making on a day to day level kind of an erratic beat. So in other words, like I have like even making lunch decisions, I try not to go, like I usually tend to eat out lunch and I try not to go to the same place every day. I always try to find new places within the Forest Hills area, which is pretty convenient since Forest Hills has a lot of choices.
Mm-hmm.
So I always try to, when I go to the same place, I try to introduce a new dish, you know, a new thing.
Oh, interesting.
So I always try to
making this big effort around novelty.
Exactly, exactly. And trying to expose myself to, or trying to introduce myself, challenge myself to go out of my comfort zone all the time, you know, to continually push my limits of how.
Where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's basically, because definitely my parents stayed in the same job, in the same area, you know, for their whole career basically. My dad was in you know, a medical group that he worked on Staten Island, and he stayed in there, that position, for a long time, for his whole career basically. And my mom also was in you know, for a long time she was in the same school, so it definitely doesn't come from my parents, because my parents all actually see this kind of professional and personal restlessness as, like, you know, they kind of enigmatic, but I think it comes from perhaps just the generational aspect of, you know, kind of, you know, that my peers having, you know, and other people and my contemporaries having this idea that they're switching careers a lot. And although I didn't technically switch careers after 10 years, I've been in the same company, the same, you know, Queens Library. But at the same time, there's a kind of a feeling that, you know, I want to continue to mimic, or not, it's not really a question of mimicking, but mainly just for myself, trying to explore new things, try new experiences. I do a lot of travel as well, and I try to always go to a different country. And I try not to visit the same country, you know, more than a few times.
So you're really making an effort on this. So more specifically, when with your job thing, like, what's the feeling of needing to apply for something different, needing to take a step up, and like how long do you sit on that feeling before you do something with it?
Yeah, I think that I'm always keeping an eye open towards opportunities. And I think that there's also a feeling like when you stay in a place too long, that there's a lot of interpolitics of a group, you know, the dynamics of a group.
Right.
And that bothers me. Mm-hmm. It kind of, I feel like once you get into the kind of politics of a group, any group, I start to feel like a little bit like, all right, you know, I want to kind of keep it a little bit at a distance. It's hard to explain because it's just a feeling, a sensation that I in the body. I feel that, you know, that
is it like annoyed or is it?
It's a low level frustration.
Yeah.
That you know, it's not even it's not the people themselves. It's mm-hmm. more like the dynamics
totally
of a situation that you feel like I've worn out. But it's not, you know, I've worn out that the dynamics of I'm trying to always find avenues for new things, fresh avenues. So once I've kind of treaded down a few avenues, I feel like, oh, I want to kind of keep it going, you know?
Right. I definitely also have this moment in groups where I start to understand and like be more aware of the group dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that yes, it's frustrating, but it never makes me want to be at a distance. It's like almost the opposite reaction of like, oh, now that I understand their dynamic, I want to like win at it.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I need to dive into that.
Exactly,
so that's a really funny thing.
Yeah. At the same time, I've had friends that I've maintained since high school. Mm-hmm. So I have a very good network of friends that I've maintained since high school. But so it's not even about the social thing. It's more about the professional.
Right.
Like my skill sets. I want to have a diverse set of skill sets.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to, I just see people who are highly successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I feel like they have had varied experiences and they've had, I kind of think to myself, you know, the most successful people are people who have many tools and I want to be able to, you know, continue to develop those varied or, you know, I know it's just a question of just hammering away.
Yeah. Know? What was your high school like? You did theater?
I did. My high school was in Staten Island. So I did a little bit of theater, but again, like kind of the returning theme of kind of they were the theater kids. And I tried to, you know, I wasn't in that clique so much. I mean, I felt like there was kind of like certain tiers of cliques or whatever. So I did some theater, you know, in the ensemble and such like that. But my senior year in high school, I tried to create an opportunity for myself
mm-hmm.
where I got together these people who were also having this feeling of alienation from the theater groups who were interested in theater. And I said, why don't we put on a production of No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre? And then, you know, I was going to direct that. And then my friend was going to direct Zoo Story by Edward Albee. So we're going to do a night at the theater. So I spent the senior year kind of working on producing or presenting this theater show. And by the end of the year, though, there was some political, like in the sense of, I'll just give a quick summary. I tell the story, like it takes me like a long time to tell. But one of the teachers in the, one of my teachers in the AP political science teacher basically had told me that he wanted me out of the class because he said to me, lack of performance, lack of ability. Hmm. And it was a very strange thing to say, and I felt very insulted. So
that's literally insane. Yeah. That's yeah. your job to make, like, teach me abilities.
Exactly,
teacher,
exactly.
That's crazy.
And this is a teacher who I'd worked with in, I'd been under this, like, I was in student government. So
yeah.
he was someone who
I
was
clearly a good student. Yeah. You got into good colleges. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, so it was a very strange thing. And then I ended up putting a pineapple on his car. So it was a very strange story, but
that's
kind of the
prank.
I'm kind of like, yeah.
Was it like a carved pineapple? Or
it was a
like
pineapple that I split in half.
Oh.
And then the half it I put in the front windshield and half it from the back windshield. And this is kind of like my kind of way of, you know, showing him up or showing that this kind of thing. And then I end up confessing to it.
You showed him
the
pineapple.
I know. I end up confessing to yeah. it. And it called attention to the way he was acting. But then ultimately, you know, the administration was like, you know, the school administration kind of called my dad in. And my dad was strangely very understanding because he knew the circumstances under which, you know, this prank had happened. So like I kind of told him a little bit about it. And he was very understanding. And he said, just, you know, kind of don't do it again kind of thing. But I ended up doing a day's detention. And I paid the teacher $20 for his car wash. So that was kind of the end of it. But
so wait, what does that have to do with No Exit?
So then the reason why No Exit didn't happen was because of that.
because you were punished.
Because I was punished. Yeah, so there was kind of the teacher who was the advisor on the No Exit project kind of basically communicated to me when I went to the student government office to just hang out. He was basically like, you're a persona non grata in this office. And I'm like, because it wasn't even like, it was just kind of, I wasn't even in student government at that time. So he's basically like, oh, you know, you did something bad. You're not welcome here. And he basically cut me off from the performance. He no longer wanted to be the advisor for the performance.
Aww.
So I was very stubborn though.
Did your friend still get to do the LB?
I was basically me kind of orchestrating this whole thing.
Got
so
it.
I was very stubborn. I tried to find an alternative area to do it in, and I made all these efforts, and I was kind of running on empty though, like in the sense that I didn't have any backing of the school. So, but then I think one of the girls who was starring in it as in No Exit, I think the last time I'd seen her, I saw her after that recently, but I'm saying the last time I'd seen her for a number of years was like, I told her, just we'll get this together, memorize your lines, we'll meet, and we'll make this happen. And then I didn't see her for like 20 years, and then I saw her. I happened to see her like randomly.
That's,
you know,
so
it's just
funny.
So strange how, yeah, you know, we leave things sometimes, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
That feels like a junction. Imagine if you had directed a play. This is kind of like a rude line of logic to take you down. So I apologize, but imagine if you had directed a play in high school, right? That's kind of a thing that stays with you.
Yeah. Ultimately, I did. In college, I did direct Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Oh, cool.
So I did get a chance to direct a full-length play. But that also was another, you know, like emotional and psychological kind of drain.
Right.
And that's also one of the reasons why I was like, oh, I probably won't go into a career in theater, because it was just such a long process.
Yeah.
And I think that was also one of the contributing factors to me being like, maybe theater isn't the right choice for me. But I think it has to do with a lot of other complicated factors were involved, in the sense of like, you know, I think if I were to return to directing, or if I were to do something with theater or something like that, at this stage in my life, you know, I would be able to handle the stresses of management and all these kinds of things. So I've done a lot of that in the library. And I've continued with some improv. I decided when I was starting with the management.
I do want to talk about improv and your return to it,
but
I want to go a little bit deeper on your direction. The first time you directed a full-length play, you found it very draining.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking more about that?
Sure.
Like, that seems like what steered you in a certain direction or away from one. So I'm curious.
So basically, it had to do with, because I put together, it had to do also with the recurring theme of like these cliques and these people, these social circles. So when I was proposed to the theater at Rutgers to do the show, they allowed me, they said, okay, they awarded me the slot. And then I had to put together a crew to help maintain it. And, you know, audition, all these process of this. And in that process, I found it difficult, more difficult than I think than other directors had. You know, I think other directors who...
Which parts of it?
Just the question of getting people to work with me. You know, I felt like they were kind of standoffish about it. And they were kind of like... And I don't think it has to do... I think it just has to do with the fact they wanted to work with their friends or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to kind of overcome obstacles. I was a commuter student. I was coming in to Rutgers, you know, to do stuff there. And then, you know, I'd done a few scenes and people, I felt like the atmosphere, sometimes they're a little colder or chilled. So finally I ended up finding a few people to work with, but the dynamics of my management and having people, I had an assistant director, I had a stage manager, and the dynamics, the group dynamics were a little weird. They were just kind of like a lot of personalities and they were kind of... it just ended up working out to be more stressful than I needed it to be.
Yeah, like it sounds like struggling relationally is kind of an area that is better for you to avoid.
Yeah, I think that I've learned kind of in my management style to, I've learned a lot since that time in leadership and management to be able to be more objective, be more analytic, be more cerebral, and that's been a strong ace in my deck.
Yeah,
you know, not to be kind of impulsive or emotional about responses to when people push your buttons or when people kind of do things that are provocative to kind of maintain a kind of objective or a kind of that observer aspect.
Was there something that led you to that way of being?
Yeah, all these experiences, the experience of, as I was mentioning, the diagnosis happened in 97, and I kind of was on a therapy medication regimen.
Okay.
So I was on, and that I would seek therapy pretty regularly. I still seek therapy. I think that the experience of being in therapy has allowed that kind of process to unfold itself in this way, in this direction. I had different therapists over the year, the past 20 years, but the process of being in therapy in general
is pretty analytical.
It's pretty analytical, yeah.
Yeah, you're having to describe exactly what happened to someone, and you have to try not to lie. And that's interesting. Yeah. I think even the process, I'm in therapy too, the process of going once a week and having to report your week to someone sort of makes you notice things more. Yeah. Like, you know that at the end of a certain week, you're going to have to describe it to someone, so you remember more.
It makes you very aware.
Yeah.
It heightens your awareness. And I think the process for me is the therapist is supposed to facilitate your ability to kind of monitor or oversee your own psychological process. And I think that's been successful for me, that it's almost like a sounding board. So I think that has enhanced my ability to be analytic and be cerebral and really up those
cool
aspects. Yeah.
Okay. So with about 12 minutes left, I want to talk about, it seems like the trend that we're getting toward is you having this job. It's a stable job and it suits you, but you're also seeking to bring your old passions, your writing, your improv, and now radio back into your life. So let's talk about all three of those.
Yeah.
Improv, what was the decision like to reintroduce that?
So when I first became a manager, assistant manager, there was always these transitionary processes where I had to really confront the kind of self-doubt that I had kind of germinating from this Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf experience, a director of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
That's
self-doubt in my leadership experience. Yeah, but also, I meant specifically about like leading groups.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, kind of that and how. And then I was like, you know, I thought to myself, I need to, the bite of the dog or the hair of the dog. So I have to go back to theater because I think that was what gelled me.
Wow.
And I was like, in order to overcome my self-conscious or overcome my self-doubt, I said improv was the best thing for me to do. Someone I know, a very good friend of mine, was doing improv, and I felt that, and I, after seeing his shows, I felt that that was a positive, he kind of communicated to me that it was a positive experience.
Mm-hmm.
People are very supportive and they help you feel your confidence. So I felt like that was appropriate, what I needed, the kind of, jolt that I needed. So I did a series of improv levels, through the People's Improv Theater. That did help me. It did overcome a lot of that self-conscious, all of that self-doubt. And in leadership, when I'm dealing with any kind of presentation or interaction with being a supervisor, I feel much more confident, much more gelled with that.
Cool.
So, yeah.
How do you think, to get into the nitty-gritty of that, how do you think that works? I've heard that, you know, we think of, or we hear about improv as therapy a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know that it ignites something in your personality, but like, what exactly do you think it was?
Yeah, I think it's like the idea that in improv, that yes and, that you're kind of, whatever comes out of you,
rolling with it.
Yeah, you're rolling with that. And it's in a sense, it was my attempt to also parallel, and I say the positives of analytic and thinking, but, you know, also play the other card, you know, of trying to develop the ability to be coming from the gut, you know, something drawing from the gut and feeling confident about whatever I say. And that improv helped develop that muscle, which I felt was a little bit lacking at that stage in my life.
Right.
So it helped me develop the ability to just say something and have it come from a whole place, a very confident place.
Cool. Yeah. That feels like a major junction.
Yeah.
Awesome. And let's also check back in on your writing. So.
Yeah.
This is sort of a thread through your life. You'd been doing it since the fourth grade without stopping, right?
Yeah. I mean, I had some periods where I was kind of like fallow in it, but just because of the fact that it was processing a realigning mm-hmm. my life. But by the time we hit the library and the management, I was taking classes and writing classes as well. So I was taking writing classes, improv classes. I always continued the education on the side. Thankfully, the library has hours that permit that. So I was continuing to develop, kind of outside education. So I did a lot of writing in that classes and such. Yeah.
Is writing something you have to make yourself do, or is it like the thing you look most forward to doing?
A mix. Yeah, it's a mix, a little bit of both. I think the main thing is that, I have these ideas that I want to express in whatever form they come out in. That's why I end up doing this Truth to Power show, because it was just another way to access. I interview a lot of poets and writers, and we're talking about kind of pushing myself into the next forum of getting into more political stuff and getting into more how the personal is political. I explore and how these our life choices and our life decisions are very charged with some kind of political aspect. We think of political as being simply a matter of state, but actually it's really a state of being.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about like the birth of your show. So mm-hmm. when was the moment where you were like, I should really do this in audio form, or like in general, like what, tell me about the birth of this idea.
So basically, when I was awarded a 2017 New Works Grant by Queens Arts Council to write a follow-up to The Escape from Samsara,
okay,
which I envisioned as Celebrity Sadhana or How to Meditate with a Hammer. So I took the themes of spiritual practice and I brought them into the celebrity world. And then I was looking at kind of the thematics in my life about sadhana and about spiritual practice and about all the different things that we've been talking about, but how to psychological process.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to think to myself, I wanted to be able to reach more people, that reach an audience that sometimes people glaze over when you talk about poetry. Their eyes kind of glaze over. They're like, they have such a knee-jerk reaction
mm-hmm.
to this kind of, the poetry as being like an academic, or so it's still hard to reach people with poetry. So I want to be able to get at what I was getting at with poetry, that poetry is a vehicle towards larger socioeconomic and personal themes in my life as well, and how, that we as people and society are moving towards a place where there's no division between the political self and the personal self, So that's why I want to be able to express that and get into conversations with people in the community that I networked with over the years of writing
mm-hmm.
and be able to platform the idea that there's nothing private, that every private decision we made is informed by actually these larger institutions, these larger historical traditions, and that we're all kind of waves on an ocean, that we're actually manifestations of these forces that are very subtle.
So interesting. There's nothing private. It's almost, I can tell it's the type of idea that no one's really brought up to me, and so it needs time to percolate, and it's gonna like stick with me, and I'm gonna be thinking about it. How's it going? And also, like, do a bit of promo. What's your next guest gonna be?
So I think it's going very well. We had the holiday episode, as I mentioned, on Truth Power, was my best friend for 25 years, who went over his transition into atheism, and then his feelings towards mental health,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty much what I think. But it was good to have a mental health counselor. He's a trained mental health counselor.
Oh, cool.
Give his opinions and give his perspectives. But of course, he's been my friend for so long that his perspectives informed, one thing feeds into the other.
Right.
And then I had a guest, Tejas Desai, who's a writer, whose his themes and his ideas of his episodes were very much, he's also Indian American, and he has a lot of themes about multiculturalism and writing, and all these themes are very much in line with what I believe, and it helps me enhance kind of my perception of these themes and my ideas, and then being able to have that conversation. And we meet people and we have friends with people, but we're not always in touch with something deeper, and I think the show allows me to have those conversations where I can get touch that nerve.
Yeah, we have that in common for sure. It's funny, this is my third episode, and I think in all three I've gotten to know members of this RP community in ways that I like never would have otherwise.
Yeah.
And everyone has these funny stories from their past. Now I know about your pineapple. I feel like Tom had a really similar.
Yeah,
you listened to Tom's episode, but the going to the zoo instead of showing up for rehearsal, that's your pineapple story.
Yeah.
What else was I going to say? Do you want to do like a little plug? Oh, who's your upcoming guest and where can people find your show?
Sure. So radiofreebrooklyn.com/truth-to-power.
Mm-hmm.
And my next guest is going to be Maria Dessa Ekwetale. And we talked a little bit about, I think the major theme of that was bearing witness and how, you know, her as a Black American bear witness to that experience and bearing witness to being a woman, being a mother, and how that can inform writing. And that's very inspirational to me because I try to bear witness to my experience and that's a very charged thing to speak our truth in these times, you know?
Yeah, you mentioned that. Observing yourself.
Uh-huh.
I wish that we had more time to get into Buddhism because I feel like we could fill up a whole other show on it. So maybe I'll have to have you on again sometime.
Thank you.
Is there anything else? Did we cover your whole life?
Yeah, I think definitely the major thematics. You know, I think that when you explore the Escape from Samsara, you'll see that you know, a lot of it.
Plug your books too.
Yeah, Escape from Samsara. And the last book, The Celebrity Sovereign, actually I haven't published yet. I'm not sure. I'm still deciding to decide if I want to self-publish again or if I want to find a publisher. So that's kind of a complicated decision-making process.
Got it. What about your memoir? What's that called?
No, I've just written like kind of brief pieces.
Memoiring my life.
Yeah, as I go along. Maybe one day I'll definitely do that.
Yeah, you'll have to.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're about out of time. I guess it's time for me to go into my credits. We're here broadcasting live from Radio Free Brooklyn Studio in Bushwick. RFB is a community-funded nonprofit organization, so funded by listeners like you. If you could go to the website to find out how to donate, your contributions are always appreciated. My theme song is by Nation of Language. Check them out on Bandcamp. If you have any questions about me or the show, or you, listener, have a twisty-turvy life story that you'd like to share as a series of junctions, please contact me on Facebook, Radio Free Brooklyn. It's Bushwick Junction on Radio Free Brooklyn is my Facebook page. You can email me, asha@radiofreebrooklyn.org. That's about it for today. Next week's guest, you know what? I'm not going to plug next week's guest yet. You're just going to have to tune in and see. It'll be a surprise. Thanks for listening.